Hello and welcome to the Oldie Podcast. I'm the Oldie's digital editor, Ferdy Rouse. Recently, Oxford University announced that Homer's epic poem about the Trojan War, the Iliad, along with Virgil's Aeneid, may be removed from the compulsory reading list on its classic syllabus. The decision was supposedly taken to attract more pupils from state schools and to help those who hadn't previously studied Latin or Greek. Today, we're joined by Harry Mount, Oldie editor and author of Amo, Amas, Amat and All That, who studied classics at Oxford, and fellow classics enthusiast James Pembroke, the Oldie's publisher, who studied it at Cambridge.
So, James, Harry, your reactions?
It is very shocking, because it's like all education now, is that it's, it's like sort of starting, my children started history with the Tudors and Stuarts. I just say that's madness. I mean, you don't know how the Tudors and Stuarts even got there. So I think that's, it's just taking everything out of context. None of the rest of classical literature makes sense without the Iliad and the Odyssey.
So is it fair to say that there's no point to a classics degree without Homer?
I certainly think it should be compulsory to read both books in their entirety. I mean, maybe, okay, I would say you should be able to translate a little bit of them just to feel some of the beauty, but you certainly should have to read them both, wouldn't you say, Harry?
I would. I think it's very sad, also on a difficulty point of view. When I sat those exams in 1991, you had to read the whole of the Iliad and the whole of the Odyssey in Greek and the whole of the Aeneid in Latin, and it was very difficult. At the time it was said, and if it's true, that it's the hardest exam in the world after the Chinese civil service exams. Now, I bet you they haven't dumbed down the Chinese civil service exams. And it was really important that it was difficult. And that's the sad thing about this, is that they're declining the level of difficulty because some schools aren't up to it. And it should be the other way around. This elite course at this elite institution should be encouraging the schools to become better, to reach up towards them, as opposed to the universities dumbing down towards schools that aren't up to the job.
But sorry, just to interrupt, I mean the Oxford model was very much a four-year course, so you had to translate all three in their entirety. You didn't at Cambridge. The idea was that you did, but it was not compulsory. So we could, there were ways around it.
You had set books, did you?
We had set books, but also, I mean, the idea was that they could fling any passage of Homer at you in your finals. But, quite frankly, it wasn't demanded of you that every week of your life at Cambridge you had to have done another book of the Iliad.
Right, right.
Do you say much?
Right.
I get the impression that you literally were sort of
you had to
constantly monitored to do it.
Well, you'd be tested in these exams on passages from all three of those works.
Yeah.
I do wonder though that if you mentioned the risk of not sort of dumbing down too much, but is there not also a risk if you keep it too elite, you'll actually the subject will die itself? It will become so minute that it won't be sort of sustainable.
No, because there's still lots of undergraduates doing it, lots of them applying to do it. Yeah, but it's still relatively small, but maybe what you do is you cut the amount of people doing it, if that's the case.
Yeah.
But education in Britain, I do feel strongly, has declined so massively at schools and universities since I was at schools and universities. And it had declined before I was at school and universities. I don't know about you, James, but when I was at school, for our A-level papers, we used to study old O-level papers from
yes,
the 60s.
Yes, it was getting,
so
yes.
It had been dumbed down by our period. It's undeniably been dumbed down.
Prose composition, i.e. English into Latin or English into Greek, was pretty much on the way out when I was there. Whereas 20 years before me in the 60s, they really were composing poems into Latin and Greek.
I did a bit of that.
But I think just going backwards, let's be clear, what Oxford are saying is they're not even going to make it part of the syllabus. Forget translating it. It will not be part of the syllabus.
No, it's not compulsory reading.
Okay, that's basically not part of the syllabus, isn't it? I mean, that really is.
Yeah.
So my point is you cannot understand any of the tragedies, so Euripides, Sophocles, or anything, without the basis of Homer. Homer is the beginning. It's not even 1066 and the Tudors and Stuarts. It is literally the formation of the Greek tragedy, of Greek philosophy. Everything, the Greek spirit is based on the heroes, the sort of the moral code of the hero. I mean, everything is based on that.
Oh, that's the staggering thing about.
So to omit it is like omitting the Old Testament from the New Testament. I mean, it's just not possible.
And the staggering thing about the Troy show, which I think is still on at the British Museum, which we went to together, is it's amazing how long it remains the number one story. So if he did write it in the 8th century BC, Homer, it then becomes, in every single temple, poem, as you say, tragedy, comedy, through ancient Greece and ancient Rome, they're always referring to the Iliad. So in this wonderful exhibition at the British Museum, you've got sculptures from early kind of 6th century BC all the way up into late Roman period in sort of 4th, 5th century AD, and they're completely obsessed with the myth, or the truth as I call it, of the Iliad.
Yeah. The other thing is that the Iliad we have is an 18th century text, which a French nobleman found from an Alexandria in the 2nd century BC. There were loads of other massive bardic myths. So these are the only two we really have left. I mean, Virgil being much later, of course, as you know. So to get rid of these is to literally wipe out a good 500 years, maybe longer, of basically ancient literature. I mean, it's just, that's it. Those are the only two we have left of the whole lot. I mean, Hesiod is a long poem, but it's not, that's 6th century, isn't it? Sorry,
I think so, yeah. And then you have these tiny scraps of so-called Nostoi, Nostos is the Greek for return, which are like the story of Odysseus returning home to Ithaca. So the tiny little scraps of other stories of returns, but literally 3 or 4 lines here. So there's 2 staggering poems from whenever, there's a great argument about when they were written, but very early on. They're the beginning of Western European literature.
And the very fact they have survived is testament to the fact that for 3,000 years, people thought they were worth it. I mean, that's for us to suddenly decide that's it is incredible. And if where Oxford leads, Cambridge will follow, and certainly the rest of the university will follow. I mean, you know, and suddenly it'll be, well, let's just do some tragedy and, hey, some Aristophanes, and no one know the context.
But is that not kind of too much of you were saying about education sort of going down the panel as a whole? But do people just not really, is it a case that people don't really care about the classics? Do they not see the value in the classics? Is that something we get the sense of?
Well, they do, but there is this difficulty that now it's almost exclusively public schools and grammar schools that teach Latin and Greek in the original. Camden Girls' School in North London was the last state school in the whole of Britain to teach Greek A-level, and it was a threatened with losing its teacher 2 or 3 years ago. I'm not sure if they managed to cling on to her. But so you do have this very, very sad division where the only people who are being taught to a very high level are spoilt, indulged, public school-educated people like me and James, and that's fantastically unfair. Of course it is. But you end up with a knock-on effect that the people who have just been better educated to do this course at Oxford and Cambridge are the ones from richer backgrounds. So it looks fantastically unfair, but that's because, as I said to begin with, the state schools which did used to teach Greek and Latin aren't anymore. So you improve the schools rather than dumbing down the universities.
Is that just a budget issue, do you think, for
the
government?
I think it's a curriculum issue, basically, isn't it? They can't squeeze in 2 lessons of language, of Latin, when they're desperate to get them to A star in English. I mean, I would think. I just think they got the lessons.
There's also an inbuilt snobbery, relatively recent one, about the classics, that they're considered the preserve of an elite. So some schools think, why should we teach this pompous, silly language? So it becomes a vicious circle.
Well, they can teach photography, you see, instead, which is really, really complex.
But it's interesting you mentioned something like photography as well, because there's something which is, one notices, especially going up through it, as I did fairly recently, the education system, it's all about transferable skills. History is not about history, it's about being able to analyse sources, it's about all that. Do you think there's, just people don't understand the value of, I mean, is that not seen in Latin and Greek? I mean, I think it's when someone says, you know, what's the skill of learning a language? Oh, it's a dead language, what's the point? It's very easy to just turn that eye to it.
Yeah, I think the defence of studying both Latin and Greek in the original is clearly that they are the foundation of all language. They are basically, in every way, they are poetry, logic, and almost mathematics, actually, to study them. So all the foundation of English literature is basically we know from Latin and Greek. I mean, Shakespeare was, read both. So we know that. And this is the greater worry, I think, with the classics, is that very soon at Oxford, I mean, already at Oxford and Cambridge, you don't have to have Latin or Greek A-level or even O-level, or GCSE, rather, sorry, to show my age, to get in. And it will soon be, I'm absolutely certain of it, you never have to do any language work while you're there.
Yes, I'm sure, yeah.
And it must happen. It's inevitable.
And they've already got courses, which I'm all for, of classical civilization. And that's a fantastic subject to learn, but I think you should keep those, but you should keep this pure, very, very difficult, highest version of the subject. Because otherwise, you don't understand it at the same level if you don't do it that high level. I love all those classical civilization courses, but they should be treated separately as an entirely different course.
You know, things when you're quoting, you know, you're quoting from a language you don't understand. How can you really quote it that well? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are so many subtleties there.
Think it's interesting. I think George Steiner, the philosopher, wrote a book once about called the poetry of language, I think, which is about how people think differently in different languages.
Yeah, exactly.
And how sort of to learn one language, to learn it properly, you need to learn how to think in that language. And if, as you say, with the Latin and Greek being the basis of, you know, basically Western language in many ways, you kind of lose that ability to learn all languages in a sense.
Yeah, there's a brilliant point made by Virginia Woolf in an essay called On Not Knowing Greek, and of course the show-off old blue stocking did know Greek, but the argument of this article was that ancient Greek, I think she's largely talking about tragedies, but they're the earliest works in Western European literature where you're coming up with many ideas and emotions and thoughts that then echo through Western European literature for the next 2,500 years, and they're the first time these thoughts have been expressed, or the earliest that they survive. And they're the closest to the original genesis of those thoughts. They're just on this side of creation. They have a sort of very, very early strong meaning to them. So like James said to begin with, to be at the beginning of these thoughts is then to think about their development throughout the 2,500 years, because until very recently, people were completely obsessed with the classics. Shakespeare, as James said, was taught.
Minimum.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it was the sort of core syllabus for British schools for 1,000 years. So they kept on reinventing these myths. And so if you know classics, you keep on seeing later the Tudors and the Stuarts reinterpreting them, Shakespeare reinterpreting their classical stories.
Just to concentrate on Homer for a bit. If they got rid of Virgil, I think that'd be terribly, terribly sad. But Virgil, obviously, as you know, was about seven, whatever we want to say, but he was 700 or 800 years later. And let's face it, Virgil really was a Roman Homer. I mean, you know, that he knew exactly who he was imitating. Augustus wanted his own Homer, and there he was in the shape of Virgil. And Virgil, I'm not knocking Virgil. He did my goodness, it's a masterpiece. But my point is, you could actually lose Virgil, and we still all be okay. You cannot lose the Iliad and Odyssey. Do you see what I mean? Because everything to do with Greece comes from it. And I actually think the Greek attitude to religion comes from it. It's not until Xenophanes in about the 6th century they start questioning religion at all. Mm. And the reason they question it is partly because of the capricious nature of the gods in the Iliad and the Odyssey.
I thought Homer was highly criticised for that, though, wasn't he? Because it was considered disrespectful, wasn't it?
No, I don't think so at all. There was no evidence he was. I don't think so. I mean, the point is, they were terrified of the gods. The gods could do anything they liked. Mm. There was no heaven in Greek mythology. If you were a good boy, nothing good happened to you. You had deipnos, which basically was dread. I mean, you know, fear, dread. So everything comes from that. I mean, even 5th century politicians, they'd have been very aware of that moral code, that heroic code. I'm not saying they live with it, but they understood that they were not in charge. Even Socrates didn't actually deny the gods' existence. He went round the subject. So it's fundamental to Greek society, to Greek democracy. It's much bigger than just two essays, two massive poems, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in modern Western European thought is really based in classical thought and Judeo-Christian thought. So,
yeah.
And much of Christian thought is also Greek and Roman, that actually a lot of the Romans we think of actually spoke Greek. Julius Caesar's last words weren't et tu, Brute, they were kai sou technon, even you, my child. And Jesus, it's thought, spoke Greek. Pontius Pilate would have spoken Greek. So I think along with the classics, I'm very bad on the Bible, but the Bible is the other great root of Western European thought. And if I had my time again, I'd learn Hebrew as well, but I haven't got time to do that.
Yeah.
So interesting, James, you mentioned Homer. A lot of debate about who he was. Do you have any particular thoughts on it? I mean, your theories.
There's an example in the Odyssey where they try and demonstrate that there were two Homers or three Homers, but it's so what? I mean, it's about two lines. I think it's just happier that he's Homer, that Homer is one person. I love the idea that he's always portrayed as blind. Mm. I think that's very interesting. I mean, you know, I think that's wonderful that he was almost beyond having sight. It was just all in his magnificent head, you know. Mm. I think it goes back to the sort of Shakespeare rubbish. I mean, it's irrelevant. The point is, there are these beautiful poems which come in one voice. If, my God, there was some community of bards who were that wonderful, so what? Great. Good luck to them. But it does sound like one voice to me, doesn't it?
Me too, yeah. It's astonishingly consistent. And then the conspiracy theorists, just like the Shakespeare ideas, they look at the inconsistencies, and there are a few lines that are repeated.
Yeah.
And Homer famously used these epithets, like grey-eyed Athene or wily Odysseus, which are used the whole time, which would have helped bards recite these great poems.
Yes,
so bards certainly did.
It's evidence of the oral tradition, isn't it?
Yeah. But there are later, there's this guy, American guy, who in the 1930s, called Milman Parry, who went out to Yugoslavia and recorded the last bards there who could recite great 10,000 line epics. And with those, there were many more repetitions, but also there were many, many more different voices, and the bard himself would make up stuff. Whereas Homer's incredibly consistent, and the quality is extraordinary. It depends when you think it's written. The received wisdom is 8th century BC. Our current prime minister once told me, no, it's definitely 6th century BC because the quality is so good. Well, I mean, his guess is as good as anyone's, but it is astonishingly sophisticated, isn't it, James?
Yeah,
even if it's 6th century.
Yeah. And I love the idea that there were other fantastic stories like this proclaimed by the bards. I think it's fantastic that there were, because obviously home, you know, the Iliad is what, 22 days or 23 days of the Battle of Troy? It's wonderful to think there were other fantastic poems which the people were equally aware of. So just to lose all that bardic tradition, I was thinking the other night, you know, if you binged watched Homer, you know, how long would it have taken? There's roughly each of the 24 books is 600 lines. They're about 10 words a line, let's say. I mean, you know, actually, you could have had the whole of the Odyssey read to you, recited to you, rather, in one night. I mean, you could just about.
Yeah,
you could. I mean, it would have been quite a big one, but it would have taken probably about 6 hours. But, you know, long winter's evenings, why not? It would have been dark at 4 o'clock. You'd have thought, wonderful, you know.
And there is the astonishing thing about the Odyssey is it's very, very advanced in terms of narrative form. So it has the first flashback in Western European literature, and there's a scene where a bard turns up at a dinner, and there's a scene where Odysseus describes, this is the flashback, describes his adventures once before he gets to King Alcinous's court. So there certainly were bards around, and the idea of people telling long, long, long stories is as old as the hills.
Yeah. I mean, there is also, I mean, you know, we haven't said to date is how beautiful it is. I mean, the description in Book 11 of the underworld in the Odyssey is mesmerising. And, you know, there again, you just see the whole of their philosophy before you. I think there are so many amazing patches. The other thing about Homer, which I always think, is the women come off quite well. I mean, they're not sort of completely second-class citizens. I mean, they obviously don't fight in battle, but you have some extremely strong characters. So it's perfect. So it's not like modern schools could say, well, this is a sexist text, because it just isn't, really. I mean, it's perfectly fair to both sides.
And very powerful goddesses as well.
Yeah.
You say that, but sort of going back to a previous podcast where we had Bethany Hughes on, she very much said that the whole, what you notice in the stories of the Iliad and the Odyssey is that at least the way it sort of sets up with Paris's judgment, admittedly not Homer, but it does kind of lead into the idea that it's a war entirely caused by and for women, basically. And it's the, so you could not say, is that not an, kind of an accusation there?
The fact is, Paris is always portrayed as the weakling, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got Paris and Helen, and then you've got Hector and Andromache. So Hector and Andromache are the right sort of couple you should be, and Paris and Helen are the wrong. I don't think Helen is any worse than Paris. They're both as bad as each other, really. They both made this bad decision, and Paris is spoiled, and, you know.
And this incredibly moving, famous scene where Hector goes off to fight and die, and he says goodbye to his wife and child. And in saying goodbye, the plume on his helmet moves up and down, and the little baby gurgles at the sight of this, and Hector's wife famously laughs through her tears. I mean, there's this sort of, again, astonishingly early ideas and beautifully written and very moving and very sympathetic portrayal of a about-to-be-widowed woman.
And also a bit of comedy, the Cyclops and all that. I mean, there is, you know, there is comedy. I mean, this couldn't... It can't have been that dull. The Iliad's a little lacking in comedy, but it makes up for it in gore. I mean, amazing battle scenes, terrifying
incredibly violent
scenes.
And Odysseus's return to Ithaca in the Odyssey is fantastically violent.
Yeah.
When he kills all the suitors.
And he kills, this is what's really unbelievable, he kills all the handmaidens. He hangs and kills them. And the last words... But the last words of the Odyssey are based pretty much the blood dripping from their feet. It's a very vicious tale. There's no forgiveness. There's no, don't worry, it's all going to be okay. It's no, you let us down, we're going to get you, you know.
On that cheerful note, I think that's a delightful place to end the podcast. James, Harry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.